This is China Business Cast, your guide to doing business in the Wild Wild East. We're here to get detailed and get personal with experienced entrepreneurs making things happen in China. If you want to learn from on-the-ground accounts of how business actually gets done, this is the program for you. Hello and welcome to China Business Cast. I'm your host, JP. Most of you will notice the long hiatus since our last episode. Well, that's due to some personal changes on my end. I left Shenzhen in the end of 2014, and currently I'm in San Francisco. But I'm glad to announce that China Business Cast will continue, and I will announce the details in the next episode. For now, please enjoy this episode we have from our archives. We have guest host Ray Ma, the Greater China Venture Partner of 500 Startups, interviewing Sol Hittite, founder and CEO of Dianrong.com, an online lending platform based in Shanghai. Without further ado, here's the episode.
Hi, it's a lovely day in Shanghai. I am on the Bund with Sol Hittite, who is the founder of Sino Lending, also now known as Dianrong.com. And I'm Ray, the venture partner for Greater China for 500 Startups, interviewing a founder, and I hope you like the content that we will be providing you. So, Sol, please tell me a little bit more about yourself. Introduce yourself to our podcast audience.
Hi, everyone. So, my name is Sol Hittite. My background is in technology. I only had three jobs in my life. The first one was with Oracle right after school. I worked for Oracle for about 11, 12 years. And my job was to create back-end servers. And later on, around 2003, 2004, the challenge was to take these systems and put them online. So the last 4 or 5 years with Oracle, I learned how to run an online service at a large scale. So in 2007, I left Oracle and joined Lending Club. I founded the company with Renaud. And my role was to build the technology for a business model that was not common in the U.S. So,
right. So Lending Club. So you were a co-founder.
That's correct.
And at that time, some of the other competitors had already come online in the space or no?
Right. So Lending Club is not the first company to adopt P2P. Right. But Lending Club is the company that perfected P2P. It's a big difference. I'll give you a couple of examples.
Right. What do you mean by that?
Exactly. Everybody likes to disrupt an industry that exists. Uh-huh. But you have to measure how much you're going to disrupt it. Because at the same time, you should not come up with something that is way too much in the future that your customers are not going to be comfortable in using. This is not a judgment, but I will compare Lending Club to Prosper, for example.
Right.
So Prosper is almost 2.5 years older than Lending Club. Mm-hmm. And for all that time, mm-hmm. they were using a bidding model. Mm-hmm. The difference between the bidding model and our model is that we set the interest rates. Mm-hmm. Prosper says, no, let the market set the interest rate. So a borrower on Prosper, mm-hmm. the old Prosper, not today, will come and say, oh, I want to borrow money at 5%.
Right.
Obviously, no investor, no lender is going to lend him money. He comes back a week later and says, oh, I'll pay 15. Mm-hmm. Still nobody. And then he goes all the way to 35%. Mm-hmm. So we know technically that there is no way, based on the capacity of that borrower, that he will be able to pay 35%. But still, that loan is listed. And right. that's a toxic product. Mm-hmm. So the financial industry, the credit industry, in my opinion, has to be moderated, has to be regulated. You cannot just leave it to the market because there are lots of emotions behind it. Borrowers will offer to pay a high interest rate just to get the loan. Even though these people should not be borrowers, should not be qualified borrowers. Mm-hmm. Lenders should not be misled by high interest rates and invested in a loan. So we should moderate it. And we saw what happened in the U.S. Mm-hmm. when the mortgage crisis happened. Mm-hmm. It was because people were like borrowing money and they did not have the capacity to pay it.
It was unsustainable.
It was right. unsustainable.
Right.
Exactly.
So can I understand what prompted you to, you know, leave Oracle where you were doing the systems architecture and decide to co-found a startup? What was the thought behind that? Had you always wanted to be an entrepreneur?
Not always, but towards the last couple of years in Oracle, I was responsible for promoting the product that I was building. So I went on a, can call it a tour around the world, convincing large companies to use our products.
Evangelizing. So you took a sales role.
Not a sales. It was more like of explaining the strategy of Oracle going forward. And yes, Oracle at that time was trying to tell the whole world that we are an internet company. Forget that we are a database company, but we are an internet company. Microsoft missed that boat. Other big companies missed that boat. Oracle actually did a very good job. And you can see today that 70% of internet-based companies use Oracle products, from the database to the application server to many, many things. So I was part of that wave. But what happened is that I go to England and I talk to British Telecom. I understand their problem. I go to Switzerland and I talk to CERN, and I understand the problem. These are very different type of institutions. That's when I start getting this virus of wanting to be an entrepreneur. But what
you wanted to problem solve.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that is exactly the turning point. Being an engineer, you wait until somebody gives you a problem and tells you, oh, find me a solution for this. You don't walk around looking for problems to solve. You have so many problems. They will be coming in specs, in conferences, and all of that. Being an entrepreneur is looking at the world. And why is it that I'm taking that road all the time? What if I change it a little bit? What's going to happen? And once you do it a couple of times, and you see, no, I think this is how it should work. That's the process of innovation. Now, once you start that first step, the next thing to do is to convince, not to sell, but to convince others to think like you. And in that second phase of convincing others, your idea is going to change. So I'm trying to convince you, you know, why do you borrow money from a bank? It's much cheaper to borrow here. And say, oh, but I'm not comfortable with the internet. No. We're going to build this and we're going to do this and we're going to do this. But I want it to be this way, not that way. So you are teaching me as a potential partner or as a potential customer, you are teaching me. So the process of innovation does not start from one, two, or three people. It starts from a large number of people. So technology, business, legal. The story of Lending Club continues to be interesting. So I don't know if a lot of your audience knows that after we opened up with Facebook and we ran the business for some time, we contacted the SEC. And they came back and they said, no, what you're doing is, did not say illegal, but they say it has to be regulated.
Right.
And that was pure innovation. So yes, it's easy to think of a problem as an engineering problem and solve it. That's simple. But thinking of a problem from a legal point of view and say, hey, we need to find a solution to this. The internet is going super fast and regulators have to adapt to those changes. So that was amazing what happened. So, okay, we are in the US. We need to protect the borrowers and we need to tell the investors, we call them actually lenders, we need to tell lenders every single risk that we know of that is involved in this. So how do you take this loan, break it down and securitize it and make the whole thing flow?
But did you have any familiarity with financial products or the marketplace, you know, of lending and borrowing at all before you started Lending Club?
No. I had absolutely no knowledge whatsoever about that. Renaud, my co-founder, did not either.
But it seemed like a very large project to take on when you didn't know anything about the industry and how it worked.
So that's the difference between being an entrepreneur and somebody who's scared from solving problems. Absolutely. But we were able to work with people. We were able to have people in the company. And that really made a great difference in what the company is today.
Do you mean in like key hires, advisors, investors?
Absolutely. All of those. So there is the team and then there is the extended team. So yes, again, in today's business, don't think that you're going to succeed by yourself or fail by yourself. It's a, it's a teamwork. If you are not able to put around you a large team that believes in you, believes in the business more than they believe in you, and if you're not willing to give concessions and make changes to accommodate the thinking of everyone in the team, you're not going to go any far. You're going to stay where you are. think of it as, I'm going to probably use a bad analogy here, but think of it as you are a politician trying to convince a large group of people that is how we should live.
Right.
This is how we should do it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it does get very hard. And sometimes it does get very hard because you don't understand the culture, like in China, for example. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when you achieve it, you feel very good. The job of an entrepreneur, I keep saying, everybody has a definition for it. My definition for it is try to convince as many people as possible that what you are doing is the correct answer. You have to convince investors.
Right.
You have to convince customers. Mm-hmm. You have to convince people to hire. You know how hard it is to convince somebody to join you and give them half of the salary they are getting somewhere else. It's pretty difficult. So if you don't have these believers, you're not creating a good business.
And those were skills you felt like you actually got out of that tail end of your Oracle career when you were evangelizing the company and its products.
Not exactly. I would say that that skill is a personality skill. In our careers, we meet people. And sometimes we are... It happens without us understanding. We're attracted to working with certain people and we're not attracted to working with others. And yes, the profile helps, but also the personality of the person helps. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very mature about how you address issues. You have to project confidence that the people that are working with you know, I'm in this and I'm in it for the long run. This is what I really believe. And you have to act on it. If you are not genuinely trying to solve that problem, people are going to see it.
Right.
If you are committed to solving that problem, people also are going to see it and they're going to support you. Everybody wants to be part of a success story.
Right.
That's what people are looking for. Even the people that just graduated from the MITs and the Stanfords, they want to be part of that success story. Many, many, many of them don't like to go work for large companies like Microsoft and Oracle and Facebook. They like to be part of a success story because it's exciting. That's what.
Well, that's a natural segue then a little bit earlier when you're talking about being an entrepreneur and convincing people. And so what convinced you? Is there any one person or market opportunity, or did you just simply convince yourself to come to China? Because that's quite a big move.
The idea of coming to China, but first I have to add something else. Renaud Laplanche is really the person that after I met with him, I knew, okay, I want to be working with this person.
So he sold you?
I wouldn't say that. I don't like the word sell.
Sell.
Okay. I like the word convince.
Convince.
Yes.
Inspired.
Exactly.
Okay.
He is somebody who had three different companies before. And he sold the last one to Oracle. That's how I get to know him.
Oh, okay.
But he is very consistent. And I was learning how to become an entrepreneur. It's something also that you do, you learn. And I was learning when I was working with him. So that gave me a very fast-paced entrepreneur MBA class, if there is such a thing. But now China is another MBA class.
Completely
That's
different animal.
Much more interesting. So you ask me, how did I end up here? Well, when Lending Club started to be popular, little by little, we start to receive a lot of emails from all around the world, from India, from Brazil, from Germany, Spain, Israel. Everybody wants us to franchise this business model. Entrepreneurs in these countries start to feel, oh, okay, this could be big in our countries. And I looked around and I saw, okay, well, which country has a chance to have a business like this and succeed? India, I don't think so. Because in order for us to run a good B2B business, you have to have three major things. Obviously, you have to have an infrastructure. An infrastructure is the internet, payment companies, and all the things that go with it. You have to have a legal structure. So P2P takes the credit industry and makes it more efficient. It does not create a credit industry where it does not exist. For example, what are your responsibilities as a borrower when you borrow money? What if you decide not to pay? What does the law say? I mean, can I sue you and force you to pay? Or can I not? So we looked at different countries, and yes, China is one of the best, actually. And the third element, which is important, is value. Mm-hmm. Our business is a volume business. Our margin is a very small percentage from the transaction. So we need to make sure that when this succeeds, it's going to be big. Mm-hmm. That's why, for example, I find it difficult to do P2P in Israel. I find it difficult to do P2P in Singapore.
Right. The market itself, the sizing is just not sufficient.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's why we got attracted to China. The other thing that attracts us to China is that there are other P2P companies. So that attracted us a lot.
Mm-hmm. That other people are doing it. Wouldn't that dissuade you? A lot of people might, you know, think the opposite and say, the market already has certain players. Why would I come in when there are sort of entrenched local players?
Competition is a good thing. If we were to follow that way of thinking, well, there were like 3-4 companies before us in the U.S. We right. wouldn't start Lending Club.
Right. That is true. Based on your history.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So every player that comes in adds something new, mm-hmm. adds something new. And there is one big problem when you are bringing a new business model, which is you have to educate the customer. You have to tell the customer, this is what we do. So when we started the first few months in the U.S., I'm pretty sure people say, oh, what is this Lending Club? Oh, it's like Prosper. Because people knew what Prosper is. Mm-hmm. So little by little, they will go say, oh, well, Lending Club hasn't, Prosper mm-hmm. doesn't. Lending Club doesn't this and this and this. And then you get reporters interested and they mm-hmm. start help in this process of educating the customer.
Right. Oh, so for a product like P2P lending, where there is some sort of customer education that needs to be done, you actually thought it was great that there are already competitors in the space educating the customer for you.
Exactly. Just to be humorous here, Elon Musk says that I'm going to create a way to move people from New York to LA in 1 hour.
Right.
More than 50% of the people writing about that project are saying, oh, this is a little bit unrealistic. Mm-hmm. I bet you if 3 other people mm-hmm. came in and just suggest mm-hmm. a small variation to what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's not going to take 1 hour. Maybe it's going to take an hour mm-hmm. and 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that the public is going to get so excited about it. No, we believe in things because we hear them multiple times from
Repetition.
Multiple sources. Exactly.
Right.
That's
right.
How advertisements work on TV.
Right.
They want you to see it as many times as possible. Once you reach 100 times, you know the product very well. Now, whether you buy it or not, that's a different story. But that's the process. It's mm-hmm. the same thing. The process of convincing somebody, the process of absorbing information and moving from like, what is that? To, oh, I understand what it is. Oh, I believe in it. It's a process. And the customers have to see it. And for me in China, I saw that happening. And like everything that happens in China, it happens super fast. Mm-hmm. Super fast.
Super fast meaning, are we talking about a scale of months, years?
What took 3.5-4 years in the U.S. mm-hmm. is taking less than a year in China.
Wow.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Our lender sales lady just this morning told me, wow, it becomes super easy for me to convince people that don't even have an online bank account to invest on our platform. Mm-hmm. And they are willing to create an online bank account just because they understand how the product works.
Wow.
Yes.
So you have to thank your competition for that.
I have to thank everybody around me for that. And the other interesting part is the word competition in China mm-hmm. has nothing to do with the word competition in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Lending Club was competing with the Wells Fargo's and the Citibanks and all. China is 1.5 billion people. Mm-hmm. There is space for everyone. And there is a very huge underserved group of people in China. I think is a huge opportunity still. Mm-hmm. And I can even imagine you take all the players and multiply that by 20, and still there will be space for all of us.
Wow. So that's one of the key learnings you have about China. You mentioned earlier that if Lending Club was, you know, your first sort of entrepreneurial MBA course, China is a little bit different. Can you elaborate on what are some of the core differences, you know, because I am focused on China investments after all. So I'm personally extremely curious. What are some of your core learnings about how China is different? Or not different, actually.
Right, right. So remember, our customers have two groups. There are the borrowers and you have the lenders. So the lenders, similar to the behavior we saw in the first years of Lending Club, meaning, who are you before I let me do business with you? And then they come and they invest 2,000 RMB, which is small amounts, okay?
Right.
Immediately, the first day or the first 5 minutes, they take back 5 RMB. So they send 2,000 RMB and they take back 5 RMB just to confirm what we told them.
Right.
So this is before
Make
investing.
Sure you exist.
Exactly.
Credibility.
And credibility. Also, it's a process. So the more trust they give us, the more service we give them.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can see it the other way around. The more service we give them, the more trust they give us back. So everything they do on our platform, there are absolutely no fees. As a lender, you don't pay any fees until you make money.
Mm-hmm.
It's only after you make money that you give us a small percentage of that.
Mm-hmm.
And people understand that very well. The first thing that our customer sees when he comes online should not be pay before you make money.
Right.
And we made that strategic decision to create the trust that we need to operate a financial service. Financial service by its nature should be, like, unless you have a huge name brand, you should be building trust first. So that 2,000, which is 2,000 minus 5 RMB now, gets invested. One loan or two loans. Then 30 days later, the payment comes in.
Right.
And we have people calling us and say, hey, somebody put money in my account. Many of our lenders did not understand how the platform works. They thought, if I'm investing in a loan that is 6 months, I'm only going to get payments after 6 months.
Right.
They did not realize that every month we give them payments.
Mm-hmm.
And every month we give them interest. And they got excited.
Mm-hmm.
They invest in other loans. 2,000 becomes 10,000. 10,000 becomes 100,000. And the number is growing. They are bringing their friends. Just like in the US. Now, the borrower side is very, 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 very different.
Hmm.
Yes. Culturally, it's okay for me in the US to take my credit card and pay for my vacation or invite my friends to a party or just use it for entertainment. Or
use money I don't have to have
exactly,
fun.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because in the US, we believe that tomorrow will always be better than today.
Mm-hmm.
And there is always opportunity tomorrow, which is what drives our economy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good philosophy, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
China, you are really naive and irresponsible if you are spending money that you don't have. The only time it makes sense for you to spend money is if you're going to make more money than what you have. For example, it is okay for you to borrow money on our platform at 18% because you are building a business that's going to yield 80%. So you give 18% to your borrowers and you keep the 62%, you are smart.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the difference. So which means that business loans are going to be much more culturally accepted than consumer loans. So that's example number one. The other product that we saw it was socially accepted here in China is student loans.
Right.
Education is a noble thing to do.
But it's also a form of investment, right? They're also hoping for higher returns, right?
Exactly. So all of that is part of what we have to use when we do our borrower customer acquisition and all. That's one thing. The other thing is, I don't know where this comes from, but in China, people don't trust each other easily. I think the reason is because China has a large number of people and it went through a different history than the US. In the US, we have checks, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I can just take a piece of paper and I say, hey, I'll give you this much money. You take it and you give me something in exchange.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even know if I have enough money in my bank account or not.
That's right.
We call that an honor system.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the honor system works in such a way that the transaction fee is going to be very cheap because we believe you are who you are and you are doing what you are saying you are doing. And if we find out that there is an exception and it's not correct, the punishment is severe. So people in the US understand, hey, there is no reason for me to get to that level. If I'm not capable of doing it, I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. Our tax system is the same way. It's all based on honor system. Mm-hmm. Now, in China, the number one issue is to make people feel that you can trust this company, you can trust this person. Mm-hmm. And there is absolutely no way you can do it unless they hear it from their friends. Mm-hmm. Because trust has to go through direct line. Mm-hmm. So like there is a trust authority somehow. Mm-hmm. So I only trust my close friends. So if my schoolmate that I've known for 10 years tells me that this person who works for this company
right.
is a serious person, mm-hmm. automatically I trust the company.
Right.
So that's how it works.
Because the system is not that transparent otherwise. So you can pretty much only see what's around you.
Correct. Right? And when it comes to financial services, people in China like to be super private about their financial business.
Really? But they ask each other a lot. How much you make? How much is the house?
But still, they don't like to say what it is that they are doing. And I don't understand that part. But when I say I don't understand it, I mean like I'm in the process of understanding these cultural things.
Right.
A lot of people have succeeded very well in China. Mm-hmm. And I tell people that are listening to me that are interested in doing business in China that, yeah, language is important. If you can speak the language, you'll be doing very well in China. But it's not enough. You have to understand the culture.
Right. You have to study it, actually. And it's constantly evolving. Even people who live here,
exactly.
right, lose touch with, you know, mainstream culture.
Exactly. There are Americans that speak fluent Chinese. Mm-hmm. There are Americans that their background is Chinese. Mm-hmm. But they keep telling me, oh, it's extremely hard for me to do business here in China. Mm-hmm. The reason is the culture, not mm-hmm. the language.
Right.
So there is a big difference between culture and language.
So how are you studying up on Chinese culture?
As many friends as possible.
Mm-hmm. Local Chinese friends.
Yes. Even when I was in San Francisco, I have a lot of Chinese friends. It's not the same. It's absolutely right. not the same. The community that we have in San Francisco is mainly from the south of China. That's another thing. Mm-hmm. China, yes, everybody calls it one China, but right. it's actually
many
right. China. Yeah. So there is south of China, there is mm-hmm. Shanghai, there is Beijing, and the way of thinking is very different, mm-hmm. extremely different. Even in China itself, administratively, it's split into three, maybe more, mm-hmm. classes. Mm-hmm. You have first year China, second year, third year. You have people in Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou, Shenzhen, have absolutely nothing to do with people that are from Hebei, Hefei, or in Changsha, or in other cities.
Right.
Like here in Shanghai, iPhone 5 is out. 5S is out, I can tell you people are buying it already.
Yep.
In China, they don't even know what that is. Maybe.
Yep.
So it's like a lot of different mm-hmm. Grouping of people.
How different is China from what you expected?
Very, very, very different.
Very,
I remember.
Very, very different.
I remember.
Good different, bad different. Thumbs up or down?
Exciting difference. Okay. Very exciting difference. I remember my first day in Shanghai. I came for a trip. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with business. And I went to Xintiandi, mm-hmm. like every foreigner that comes in.
Right. That's my most popular expat hangout spot.
Correct. I'm looking around. Where are Chinese people? Mm-hmm. Like, no, these are Chinese people. No. I'm looking for the real Chinese people. These are the real Chinese people. It looks like an European city. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's a very well-organized city mm-hmm. compared to what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was very interesting. I found it to be very expat-friendly, very foreigner-friendly. Mm-hmm. Then I lived in the south of China.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I lived for 2.5-3 months in Shenzhen.
Uh-huh.
Then I came back to Shanghai. I was thinking about living in Hong Kong, but my real advice to people that are interested in doing business in China, Hong Kong is not China. China is not Hong Kong. If you really want to do business,
yes.
If you really want to do business in China, you have to be in China.
Mm-hmm.
I understand it might be more comfortable to be in Hong Kong, but you're going to miss a lot if you're not in Shanghai or in Beijing or in Guangzhou. You will miss a lot. And as an entrepreneur, you should not miss anything.
What was the thought process you took? I mean, other than the market opportunity, which you sort of already explained, but were there any other reservations you had about coming to China? I mean, how did you find your co-founder? You have a whole team here. We're sitting in your office, and for the benefit of listeners, it's a very nice office right next to the Bund with a full view of the Huangpu River. So, I mean, this only took you, what, how many years to put together?
16 months.
16 months. Yeah, very, very impressive. So how did you find your founding team? You know, how did you get all this started from the point where, okay, this was a good market opportunity to, okay, you know, full steam ahead?
Right. So I've known Kevin through his family back in San Francisco.
Kevin is your co-founder?
Kevin is my co-founder, Kevin Koo. I've known him for some time before. Actually, I was saying the first time I came to China, it was an invitation from him to come to his wedding.
So
we were friends before we did business. A year after that, he came to the US and invited him to Lending Club. And he was in the office with us for 2 weeks. And he went talking to everyone and, oh, what do you do here? And how do you do here? And he came back to me and he said, I really would like you to come to China. This will be a good business. So at that time, I told you, we were also thinking, should we go to, because, you know, in Silicon Valley, you succeed. People are going to start. What is your global story? Where are you going next? So before, people will go to Europe. Before, people will go to Canada. Why? Because the language, the culture, and all of that. But today, people come to Asia. They come to China, and because it's one of the most dynamic places in the world. That's why I came to Shanghai. It's a combination of multiple things. A combination of, like what I explained before, the three criteria, infrastructure, legal, and volume. The fact that I met people that are going to help me into this. It's not something that you can do by yourself.
Right, you said the importance of team earlier.
Correct. But then, after I announced it to my friends, and my family, and I said, okay, I'm going to do this in China. People start telling me, are you sure you want to do this? Which is a natural reaction.
Right.
A natural reaction. People are usually afraid of things that they don't know. We, and by we, I mean entrepreneurs, we embrace things that we don't know. It's like, yes, the excitement, the challenge is when you do things that you don't know. That's how you grow. So I'm not trying to say that coming to China is driven by a personal need to grow. No, coming to China is because I really believe that what we have, China needs. And I really believe that it's going to add to our profile and reputation. And it's a good business opportunity. But everything that you do, if it does not have an element of your self, of your person, it's not worth doing. We will all get old one day and we will look back and say, oh, what have you done in your life? Yes, I built the technology for Lending Club, the largest P2P company in the world. Very good. But how many of us can say, I went to a country where I had absolutely no connection whatsoever with that country and I was able to build this much? I think that's very interesting.
So China for you was a great opportunity, but also you just saw it as a big personal challenge.
Correct. And I'm not doing something that is out of the ordinary.
Right.
I am part of this wave. We've always been part of a big wave. Like, yes, volume and the size of the business is different. But look at Apple. Apple is in China. Chinese people like Apple products.
Stores everywhere,
correct. So I'm not Apple, I am not Starbucks. Starbucks is another example. Very successful in China. I'm not as big as those, but I am part of that wave. The wave that we call globalization. So, yes, I am a product of that. I was born in a different country. I grew up in a different country and I did business in the US. Now, time to come to China. And that's what I think is making things very interesting.
Right. You already have a very international perspective and background from your upbringing, education, and job experience.
That's correct.
So maybe it was a little bit easier for you to make the jump. So what are some advice that you would give to entrepreneurs, startup internet or mobile internet entrepreneurs in particular, who are maybe thinking about coming to China? What would you say is the right way of looking at and assessing this opportunity? Because it's not the right opportunity for everyone necessarily, right? You talked about the market and having a team. So you have those at least two things in place. Any other things that you think they should be aware of or concerned about,
right,
thoughtful about?
So things that will convince them to come to China, I'm pretty sure they can read in any article, document, or book.
Right.
So those are easy. I would like to mention the things that should not prevent them from coming to China.
Okay.
And at the top of my list, if I take my product to China, somebody in China is going to copy it and is going to duplicate what
IP
I'm doing.
IP theft, hyper competition.
Correct.
So how do you address that?
The same way you address it everywhere. Mm-hmm. So what is the issue? Is the issue that there is no law that protects you? Or is the issue that you don't trust the people that you work with? Mm-hmm. So to each, there is a solution. But that should not be preventing you from doing business in China. In the US, people can copy you. Yes, you have a patent and all of that, good. But today, it's all about service more than the product. Look at what you have and what's natural to you. Mm-hmm. So if you want to have a competitive edge, look at things that you can produce at unlimited rates that your competitors don't have. These are things that come natural to you. For example, for us, we are very good at producing technology. And we attract more and more people that are of technical background. Mm-hmm. That is our strength. We understand the internet very well. That is our strength. We have shown that we can do it once in the US. It's easy for us to attract people that want to be part of this thing in China. So focus on those things. As a foreigner in China, you naturally have few things that a local Chinese person does not have.
Right.
Now, what makes it interesting is that you take what you have and you find a good local person and you partner with them. And then nobody can compete with you. So competition is a natural thing that you have to deal with it all the time. Mm-hmm. But you should not be scared of it. The same way for people that understand technology, we always talk about security. Mm-hmm. Security. Oh, if I'm building a server, it has to be secure. Of course, it has to be secure. But the best, most secure server is a server that does not exist. So there is nothing to break in. But that's not what we should be building. We should build a server. And we have to make it secure. So I'm not saying relax your security criteria. What I'm saying is do not let the opportunity go by because of security concerns.
Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Same thing in business. Mm-hmm. Do not say, I'm not going to China because somebody's going to copy my business model. Somebody's going to copy your business model if you're in China, in the US, in Canada, in Australia, everywhere. If your issue is Chinese people, there are Chinese people everywhere. They work in all companies.
Right.
So what is really the issue? Competition is there to be with us. That's number one. Number two, that's the second most important subject that people talk about is the government.
Yes, especially in your space.
Right. Mm-hmm. There are other spaces that are even more dominated by what the government says more than us. So, yes, government is important. You have to respect the laws. You have to do business the same way the Chinese government wants you to do business. You cannot take something from the US and do it in China because if it doesn't fit with the Chinese plans, it's going to hurt the country. Don't be a Google in China. Be a Tencent in China. Mm-hmm. Or be a Baidu in China. So we all know what happened with Google and things like that. So now people are not getting the basic Google services that we know of, things are slow because somewhere, somehow, somebody made the wrong decision and thinking that we can do business in the US the same way we do it in China. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. The laws that we have in the US fit the US because the institutions of our government in the US are very mature, mm-hmm. and they can manage any situation that arises. Mm-hmm. The challenge in China is that you have to manage 1.5 billion people. Mm-hmm. It's not only Shanghai and Beijing, which I explained are very different. So you have to understand how the government should think about managing all of this. Give you an example. The best thing that could happen to our business mm-hmm. is that there is an official P2P license.
Right.
And we would love that. Actually, we will welcome that.
Yes.
And I do believe it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But take the example of third payment companies. Mm-hmm. Companies like Alipay, TenPay, right. and all of those.
They're just getting their licenses now, right?
Exactly. But mm-hmm. they've been operating for 10 years.
Right.
And imagine if they did not exist. Mm-hmm. The e-commerce in China would not have existed mm-hmm. because nobody is going to buy something and you don't have an infrastructure to pay. Mm-hmm. So for a good period of 6-7 years, they were operating without a license, but they were not operating in a completely wild way. Mm-hmm. The government was watching. The government was learning. Mm-hmm. It takes time for the regulators to understand what's going on.
Right.
And then decide whether or not to regulate it or not. So that's one thing. They have to understand what they're doing. So for that, you have to give them time. Mm-hmm. The second thing is China is a country that has been changing for the last 30 years. If they have to regulate everything, they would be building nothing. Mm-hmm. So they wait uh-huh. for something until it becomes big enough.
Right.
And then regulate it.
It's a wait and see.
It's an opportunity mm-hmm. cost. Mm-hmm. Okay, for example, in the US, you could have the smallest business mm-hmm. or the smallest idea, whether it's a religious idea or a human rights idea, even if it is really small, even if it affects a small majority of the people, mm-hmm. the government is going to regulate it. Mm-hmm. In China, I think the idea is, hey, it's not big enough to waste our resources on it.
Right.
Yes, maybe it's not the ideal situation, but we're not going to waste our resources on that because we still have to regulate airports. We have to regulate healthcare. We have to regulate pharma. We have to regulate who is allowed to consume coal more than others. There are so many things to regulate, and you don't build a country in 30 years. You build a country in 300 years. But what's happening here is happening in a fast pace. Mm-hmm. So that's what you understand mm-hmm. when you live in China.
So you have to learn basically to deal with a lot of ambiguity around government policy.
Why do you call it deal? Mm-hmm. You call it, I mean, for me, when you use the word deal, it's like a negative connotation to it.
Okay.
It's like, this is what it is. Exactly. This is what it is. If you want to do business here, this is how we do business. Mm-hmm. You are welcome to do business here. So you adapt mm-hmm. to what it is. And again, mm-hmm. entrepreneurs have to understand how to take advantage mm-hmm. and how to leverage mm-hmm. whatever exists.
What would you say the Chinese government or Chinese society, whatever business world, you felt very welcomed here as an expat entrepreneur?
Anywhere I go, mm-hmm. I get asked to talk about my profile and my experience, and people are really looking forward to becoming international. Mm-hmm. Last week, we were just in Beijing mm-hmm. in the technology park, and we received an invitation to join them there and open mm-hmm. an office there, and mm-hmm. they are facilitating everything for us there. So, yes, China is really entering the global arena. And they do understand that in order for them to do that, they have to convince people from other countries to come and share with them. And some of the meetings that I've been invited to in Beijing are all about, please tell us, what can we do to make it more interesting for people like you? So mm-hmm. there is a will to make China international. But it's going to take time.
It's going to take some time. It's growing pains still.
Yes. Again, I go back to that same word, mm-hmm. trust. Mm-hmm. There was one presentation that was given by two people, one from China and an American CEO. I forgot his name, but I just caught the presentation when I was there. They're both saying the same thing. Okay, we are not comparing the Beijing Technology Park to the Silicon Valley. We said numbers, but the point is not to say which one is bigger, this one or this one. But forget about all of that and think about a person, whether he lives in China or lives in the US, and he needs medication because he's going to die if he doesn't have that medication. So having a technology park or having an environment that helps doctors or researchers to create that medication so it gets to that person is much more interesting to him, whether you have 8,000 more foreigners in China than in the US. At the end of the day, we're all humans. And I don't think we should wait until we discover another species in some other planet, then we unify ourselves against them. At the end of the day, we have challenges that are similar to each other. Mm-hmm. People in China suffer from the lack of good healthcare and medication. Mm-hmm. People in the US suffer from the lack of good healthcare because of our system and the things that we have in the US. So these are similar problems. And everybody agrees today that the only way to solve those things is innovation and technology. So, of course, wherever we go, we are very welcome because we offer solutions to these things.
Great. Thank you, Sol. To conclude, basically, you're saying you've had a pretty positive experience in China, it seems like, and that you encourage entrepreneurs, as long as they have solutions that are good for the Chinese market and they can see a market opportunity here, you would encourage them to come here, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time. And we will check in back with you with our next podcast.
Thank you.
Hope you've enjoyed this episode of China Business Cast. Head over to chinabusinesscast.com and enter your email to get on the list. I'll announce guests before I interview them, and you'll get a chance to submit your question for the show. Till next time, thank you for listening.